Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'm talking to Jesse Rhodes, who is returning to the podcast for the second time with his new book, Ballot Blocked, The Political Erosion of the Voting Rights Act. Jesse's book is published in 2017 by Stanford University Press. Jesse, welcome back.
It's wonderful to be here, Heath. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for sharing the book. We're not going to be talking a lot about how the book looks, but the book looks amazing. It has this great cover, which our description won't do it justice. But as way of introduction to you, maybe you could talk just a little bit about yourself, where you've gone from your first book to your second here, and maybe you just briefly describe how this book looks, because it's such a cool cover. So just introduce us a little bit again to yourself.
Well, I should start by talking about the cover, and I was very excited about it. The staff at Stanford University Press did a really outstanding job. So just to describe the cover, it's a very dramatic cover. The image is of a partially torn ballot, and most of the cover is actually empty black space. With the ballot occupying a small part of the top of the cover. And of course, the ballot, including the title of the book, as well as my name as a candidate, of course. And so, you know, obviously a callback to the content of the book. And it's very dramatic and I think very powerful, given that the theme of the book is about the gradual and very serious diminution of the scope of the Voting Rights Act and the authority of the federal government to protect the voting rights of vulnerable groups in American society.
Yeah, the cover is nearly, and I think quite a nice hat tip to the Spinal Tap album cover. If you've ever seen that movie, it's really close to that in a way that I'm sure was unintentional, but very funny at the same time.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good point.
You can hang these together at some point. I forgot what the name of that album they fictitiously did, but it had a very similar cover for those that have watched that movie. So let's talk about the book. And also mention that you're still at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and are now an associate professor of political science there. So let's talk about the book. There are these bookends that your book fits between that really make up what you're talking about. And those bookends are the original Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the more recent Supreme Court decision, the Shelby decision. Let's get to the Shelby decision later, but let's first, perhaps you could outline the basics of the Voting Rights Act, the big components of it, and maybe a little bit about the politics of its passage in the 1960s.
Right. So as you said, that the book really, and I think the intention of the book was to fill the gap in the political history between the enactment of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Shelby County decision of 2013 and what's happened since. And just briefly before I get to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, I wanted to emphasize, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, that the rationale for that is that while there's been an enormous amount of research on the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and how it came to be enacted, and there's an enormous amount of research on the Shelby County decision and the consequences for contemporary voting rights enforcement, there's a real gap in our understanding of that really critical intervening almost 50-year period. And a lot of what has been discussed is this narrative of kind of bipartisan consensus in support of voting rights. And the book as a whole really seeks to raise questions about that narrative of bipartisan consensus. So I can talk a little bit about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so the critical purpose of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was to give the federal government the tools to be much more actively and preemptively engaged in addressing discriminatory actions that could interfere with the right of individuals to vote and with the right of individuals' votes to have equal weight in the political process. That before 1965, the tools that were available to the federal government were primarily lawsuits, so efforts to enjoin discriminatory practices in elections. And that was very clearly an inadequate set of tools that throughout the South, states and localities very aggressively worked through both legal and extra legal means to deny the ballot to African American citizens. And the federal government before 1965, you know, they would get involved in lawsuits to try to prohibit those illegal actions, right, which were clearly illegal under the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. But the federal government was really engaged in kind of a process of whack-a-mole, that localities would do things that were unconstitutional. The federal government would try to initiate suits when and where it could. Of course, given its limited resources, it could only do what it could do. But then those suits would take years, and elections would go by, people still wouldn't have access to the ballot. And as a result, the federal government was always playing catch up, always way behind. And as a result, throughout the South, millions of people were denied access to the vote, unable to register to vote, even if they were successful in registering, unable to successfully cast a ballot. And so what the Voting Rights Act did was give the federal government new tools to become more aggressive and more active on the front end. And so it strengthened the authority of the federal government to initiate lawsuits. But really what was critical was what's known as Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which authorized the federal government to what's called pre-clear voting changes, changes in election rules, changes in registration rules, changes in election systems, ultimately, that could affect, adversely affect the right of African-Americans and other people of color to vote and to have their votes meaningfully counted in elections. And so until 2013, when the Shelby County decision effectively rendered Section 5 inoperative, that really was the heart of the act, this authority to pre-clear proposed changes in election rules.
Now, written into the law, the original law, is a sunset clause that compels Congress to extend the VRA, Voting Rights Act, on occasion. Has this portion of the act been a contentious process for Congress, or has it generally been consensual for its continuation?
Well, that's right. So the structure of the Voting Rights Act was divided into so-called permanent provisions, primarily relating to the federal government's litigation authority, and so-called temporary provisions, in particular Section 4, which established the formula which identified jurisdictions with histories of discrimination in elections for preclearance coverage, and Section 5, which established the preclearance process. And those sections did sunset periodically, and Congress had to affirmatively reauthorize those provisions. And so that process occurred several times in 1970, 1975, 1982, and 2006. And at least with the final votes, by overwhelming margins in both houses of Congress, Congress reauthorized those provisions. And at the same time, with each reauthorization, it further extended the scope of the statute, primarily by overturning adverse Supreme Court statutory decisions, and by including more groups under the coverage of the Voting Rights Act's provisions. Hispanics and Latinos, people who English is not their first language, and so forth.
So given what you just described, you would describe this as a wide bipartisan consensus that the the thrust and structure of the Voting Rights Act is the right way to make policy. But at the same time, there is this other cross current, which is Republican opposition. And much of what you do in the book is to try to reconcile the continued legislative support by Republicans for the various provisions of the Voting Rights Act, despite the fact that they appear to disagree with it on ideological and maybe even more important than ideological, on political grounds. So how do you square that? If that's the central puzzle, why is that puzzle exist? Why are they in conflict between their legislative strategy and their ideology and politics?
Right. And so to answer that question, I just want to first highlight a few things about the nature of Republican behavior, and then I can talk about the rationale for it. So first of all, on the legislative side, it's absolutely the case that when you look at final passage votes, that there was broad bipartisan consensus on final passage for the reauthorization and extension of the provisions of the VRA. However, when you drill down a little bit and start to look at votes on amendments that would limit the scope of the Voting Rights Act or institute new sunset provisions on the Section 4 and Section 5, or even other sections like the minority language provisions, or that would strip the minority language provisions from the Act, you start to see partisan divisions on those pre-final passage votes, on those amendment votes. Republicans are increasingly, especially after 1975, more likely to support weakening provisions for the Act. And then once those proposals, those amendments are not adopted, that Republicans come around and support on the final passage vote. And so there's a dynamic in which many Republicans vote for weakening amendments, but then once those amendments fail, they vote for final passage. And so the legislative process itself is more contentious and more divided than the final passage votes indicate. But then I think also, as you were suggesting, Heath, that when you look at other aspects of the political process, if you look at judicial nominations and appointments to the Supreme Court, if you look at administration of the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act under Republican presidents, that you see decisions that are much less enthusiastic about vigorous federal enforcement of minority voting rights, that very consistently from the presidency of Richard Nixon through the presidency of George W. Bush, Republican presidents nominated jurists who everyone expected would have a narrow view of voting rights cases when they were on the court, and then subsequently, in fact, consistently delivered votes against voting rights plaintiffs, votes in support of a narrow interpretation of the Act. And at the same time, Republican presidents adopted administrative strategies that tended to reduce the scope of federal enforcement. So they consistently promoted to positions of power within the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice individuals who were not sympathetic to a strong interpretation of the Voting Rights Act. Those individuals very consistently worked hard to centralize authority within their own persons, within their offices, to exercise greater control over career staff within the Civil Rights Division, right? So because career staff tended to be enthusiastic about strong voting rights enforcement. And with these types of behaviors, you did see important changes in the vigorousness of federal enforcement during Republican administrations. You saw important declines in the frequency of objections to state and local election law changes. You saw declines in the number of suits that were supported by the administrations against jurisdictions with potentially discriminating voting arrangements and so forth. And so very consistently from the late 1960s through George W. Bush administration, the conclusion in 2008, Republicans were using these non-legislative strategies to limit the scope of enforcement.
And part of the burden on you in this book is to do more than simply sort of describe what's happened, but also to show some level of intent and answer the why question. So, you know, why do it this way? And the, you know, one answer is, well, it's just more, it's just the better way to do it. But your answer is a little bit different. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about that why question, what you've discovered, because you've done incredible detailed historical archival research that gets to motivation, gets to intent. Without describing all of the intent, I wonder if there are any examples that stick out to you in the book that get to the explanation for why this has been the strategy over this time period.
Well, the essential, essentially the explanation for this behavior is political. That on the one hand, Republicans had a lot of ideological and political reasons to be unenthusiastic about a vigorous federal presence in enforcing minority voting rights. Some Republicans and their constituents had racially conservative attitudes. They were not enthusiastic or focused on expanding the voting rights of citizens of color. Other Republicans, you know, they might have in the abstract believed that voting rights were important, but they were more concerned about the specter of big or overweening government. Still, other Republicans had constituents who were anxious about the practical political consequences of expanded minority political participation in politics. Some Republicans were primarily focused on electoral strategies, and their big concern was about increasing Republican political involvement and support in the formerly solidly Democratic South. And so there are a lot of factors that made Republican politicians disinclined to support vigorous federal enforcement of minority voting rights.
Now,
but on the other hand, oh yeah, I'm sorry, Heath. But on the other hand, there was an important electoral imperative that made Republicans nervous about being too aggressive in their efforts to limit the scope of federal enforcement. And that was the perception, and I think the correct perception, that overly aggressive efforts to limit the scope of minority voting rights would be opposed not only by voters of color, but also by moderate whites. That the Voting Rights Act is what people call a super statute. It has a kind of quasi-constitutional status. It's venerated. It's viewed as kind of one of the key pillars of contemporary American politics. And being perceived as attacking that, it, Republicans feared, would be perceived as tantamount to attacking the Constitution and the idea of civil rights itself. And so Republicans were very anxious about how attacking the Voting Rights Act would affect public perceptions of the party. And so what we see is a strategy in which, in these very high-profile, transparent politics, legislative politics over the Voting Rights Act, Republicans acquiesce to make it appear that they are supportive of voting rights and to protect their reputation. But in these less transparent, more behind-the-scenes venues of administrative politics and judicial appointments, they pursued the objectives that accorded with their core ideological
now,
and political
things
commitments.
Change and change after the most recent in during the Bush administration, the most recent re-up of many of the provisions of the law. What gets us from that time period of the mid aughts up through the Shelby decision and even sort of more up through today. What's changed in the politics of the Voting Rights Act that sort of leads us inevitably to the Shelby decision and to a repositioning of the conversation about electoral rights and voting rights? Maybe you could just sort of we can end our conversation talking about the more contemporary time period.
Well, I think that through 2006, not much had changed. So you saw Republicans, a very conservative Republican Party in Congress, a very conservative Republican President George W. Bush, ultimately come out and overwhelmingly support reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act again for 25 years until 2031. At the same time, you saw George W. Bush continue on the path of his Republican forebears that he really aggressively and some would claim even illegally took steps to reduce the scope of federal enforcement. And he appointed very conservative judges to the Supreme Court. What happened with Shelby County was that it really changed the playing field and the who bore the standard of the burden of promoting voting rights and proposing voting rights proposals. So what really critically happened with Shelby County was that it judicially cleared the deck of the preclearance process. By striking down the coverage formula, it rendered the preclearance process inoperative. And Republicans have been trying to weaken preclearance by a variety of means for a long time, but they knew that they couldn't do it too aggressively. Well, with Shelby County, the Supreme Court handed them a gift. It did the dirty deed for them, so to speak. And so now with the preclearance process inoperative, Republicans no longer bore the burden of trying to explain why the voting rights should be limited. Instead, Democrats were in the position of having to justify big changes to the Voting Rights Act as it existed. And so Shelby County kind of flipped the burden from Republicans to Democrats and put Republicans in this position where instead of having to justify their novel proposals, they could instead exploit the characteristic tendency of Congress to do nothing and put the burden of proof on Democrats to justify these changes. And so that's really where we are today, since Shelby County, Democrats tried on numerous occasions to try to resurrect the preclearance process. Republicans have said, no, it's not necessary. And meanwhile, at the state and local levels, we've seen these big fights over voter ID, over other restrictive voting rules. And again, because the federal government doesn't have the means to preemptively review these changes, their opponents of these changes, so civil rights activists, Democrats, and so forth, have to, after the changes are enacted, go through the litigation process to challenge them in court. And so we're kind of ironically, in some ways, back to where we were before 1965.
An amazing way to end this conversation, and also the book, this topic of voting rights, the actual Voting Rights Act, and also the way in which it's being played out at the state and local level is so in the news right now that your book, Ballot Blocked, The Political Erosion of the Voting Rights Act, published in 2017 by Stanford University Press, is a must read. Jesse, thank you so much for your time today.
Heath, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's a real pleasure.